G2 Cloud is storming into your podcast player today with product news from VMware, SolarWinds, and startup juggernaut Pensando. How can a startup be a juggernaut? That's an excellent question, as so many people we ask give us that response. That's an excellent question. And it is. So you're going to have to stay tuned to find out what these emerging monsters have built to power clouds. I'm Ethan Banks at EC Banks, and with me is book writer, plural site instructor, and lunar colonist, Ned Bellavance at Ned1313. And this is Day 2 Cloud, the podcast taking the sting out of cloud operations. We are here to share practical knowledge with subject matter experts from all over, discussing tools and techniques and architecture, products, and more. Professional career development. We hope that's what you're getting out of all this. In April 2020, I attended a virtual event where several vendors with cloudy products showcased their wares, and I listened carefully, and I took several pages of notes, and now Ned and I are going to talk through some of the highlights from those presentations. And there's a theme here that I think I found through all these presentations, solving problems related to distributed computing, Ned. Distributed computing, when we get down to cloudy stuff, a lot of it's got to do with that, doesn't it?
It really does. I mean, that's sort of the definition of cloud native, right? It's no longer doing these monolithic applications. You've distributed your computing and made it that much more difficult to manage and patch and deal with and connect all the different components. The most interesting thing to me about distributed computing is all the complexity that you add, and you got to make sure that whatever benefits you're getting outweigh the additional complexity and administrative overhead you've added to your application. So hopefully you can show some ways of reducing that administrative burden through the products that you learned about in Cloud Field Day 7.
So, well, we didn't script this part of the show, so it's kind of like the perfect segue you just gave without knowing you were giving it, because as we talk through these products, that's exactly what this is all about, helping solve the distributed computing problem, making it easier deal with a lot of that stuff. Again, that's the undercurrent.
Have we mind melded? I'm moderately concerned now.
Mind melded. If that was a thing, would you really want to do that? Let's just say we don't want to know what's in my
head.
We don't want to know that. Yeah, exactly.
Fair enough.
All right, Ned, You mentioned Cloud Field Day 7, and that's exactly the event that I was at. Techfieldday.com, if you visit there, they have all sorts of different Field Day events, and I was at this Cloud Field Day 7 event, which we attended virtually. Since we're still in the middle of this global pandemic thing, the first presenter that was up was VMware Cloud on AWS, VMC, VMware Cloud. And again, on AWS, so they talked about lots and lots and lots of things over a period of, 4 or 5 hours of presentation. And Ned, I wanted to get your take before we dive into what the VMC folks talked about. I wanted to get your take on this product. Let's assume people kind of know what it is, because back in the day, you weren't in love with it, I think is a fair way to say, from a blog post you wrote back in maybe 2017.
It was very incisively titled VMware on AWS, You're Doing It Wrong. So I wouldn't say I pulled a whole lot of punches on that one. And I actually expected a dogpile in the comments from bleeding heart VMware rah-rah cheerleaders. And I didn't get that. I was a little surprised, which maybe indicated that they were having their same level of trepidation, but not as outwardly. But basically, VMware on AWS, the whole idea was, hey, you could run VMware on bare metal in an AWS data center, and we will manage it for you. And in my mind, I was like, how's that different than any other colocation facility that has managed VMware? And the response was, well, it's closer to AWS. Okay. And? Yes, and? I feel like they may have answered some of those questions, so I guess I'd tee it back to you. Like, what did they present to you over the course of this that stood out to you as an actual advantage to running it in AWS as opposed to any other colocation facility?
Okay, so to me, the way the presentation came across, well, first of all, it's not a new product anymore. It's 2020 now, so the thing's got some years on it. I still see it as a transitional technology that can help you as a company get to cloud native eventually. So I look at it this way. If you have a directive to get to cloud for whatever your reason is as a company, executives just decide this is a thing we're doing, we're going to cloud, and you begin to look at cloud technology and you realize our applications do not map well into cloud native. Okay, what's your answer? This is a good answer, VMware Cloud on AWS. Because yes, you can say you're doing cloud, but you don't have to retool your apps. You don't have to change your operations particularly. You've still got a relationship with a vendor that you know and understand. and has a robust ecosystem. So you can do that. Build a software-defined data center on VMC. It is in the AWS cloud, but is not AWS. It looks and feels and is, in fact, VMware running on bare metal, just as it happens, co-located in an AWS facility. And Ned, I mean, the thing that I took away is that it's growing up. So for example, Ron Fuller, who's a networking expert with of long standing, gave an overview of all the different networking technologies and the ways that you can connect your VMC SDDC to the rest of the world and how you do that plumbing, how you even connect it to your AWS VPC that you might have in the same data center somewhere, and how that would work.
Right. One of the things that I know about the product from previous presentations is that it does use a VPC to communicate with the larger internet, as well as your data center and everything else. It basically takes a pair of virtual network interfaces and puts them on a VPC. And then VMware has some sort of private link in to do the management components. So it is leveraging some of the AWS networking technologies to get that connectivity. What was difficult prior to some of the new offerings within AWS was the way that you could attach to other networking constructs within AWS. AWS has since introduced the Transit Gateway,
yep,
which plays heavily into how you can take a bunch of different VPCs and mush them all together and get them talking. Because before, you had to do peering and like anything else. When you're trying to create a full mesh between nodes, the number of connections you have goes up exponentially.
Well, the short answer is that a lot of what VMware presented talked about how these things are changing, how these connectivity methods are growing up and maturing. They didn't talk much about how your VMware SDDC that's running up in the cloud, they didn't get into too much detail about how it connects to your AWS native environment, you know, with Transit Gateway and all that stuff. They kind of alluded to it here and there. They did emphasize NSX, VMware NSX, which is their distributed networking architecture that allows you to do things like build a centralized firewall policy that's distributed and pushed out to the hypervisors, you know, and embedded in the vSwitches and such, and how that maps and what that looks like inside of VMware Cloud. In other words, they know how to do this from a variety of ways now and have reference architectures that can guide you on exactly what the best way is to do that. But connectivity to native AWS services, I wouldn't say in these presentations was emphasized, other than yes, you can. There are ways that we can do this, and there were some slides about that, but it wasn't anywhere that they spent a lot of time. To speak more to the maturity of VMware or VMC, I'm just going to say VMware on cloud or VMware Cloud. They also had the HCX product. Now, do you happen to know what the HCX product is all about, Ned?
I have heard some people talk about it. One of the VMUG I attended last year, I sat behind a guy who started talking about VCX and didn't stop for about 30 minutes. So I got a good idea of how his company was specifically using it. And they were using it to do bulk migration from one data center to another because of the way HCX handles it. And he was like, it's like SRM, but better. And I was like, okay. Awesome, dude. I'm glad that worked out for you. So I guess they're now applying that magic to the VMC product as well.
Yeah, exactly. They showed us the HCX GUI. It was a very nice UI for exactly, I think I'd summarize it very similarly, moving things around to different software-defined data centers. That's it. And so the scenario here was just, you know, picking up like a workload that's in one SDDC and then moving it to another, but then having a nice UI that just makes it very simple for you to do that. If you have a higher than your average, like LAN latency is like very small, right? You got a millisecond or less. And so if you're doing a vMotion, well, that's fine. But when you get into trying to vMotion, you know, gigabytes of data that it takes to pick up and move this virtual machine from one place to another, latency plays in and it's a challenge. But HCX takes care of that for you with magical WAN optimization and so on. And yeah, they can. So when you
sprinkle
have a higher,
on that magic fairy dust. Yeah.
That's right. but in all sincerity, that is That is part of it, WAN optimization. Mm-hmm. So when you've got these two software-defined data centers that probably aren't sitting next to each other because they are, wherever they are, different AZs, different data centers or regions all together, you can still, within some limits, move things around, and HCX just makes it easy to do that. I don't think this is a DR strategy by itself, Ned, but it is a tool that just makes it simpler to move stuff around. That's the best way I can think to describe it.
Right. Their primary tool for disaster recovery remains SRM. Mm-hmm. That's what they're using to do the data replication, constant data replication over time, and then generate these failure plans that can be executed through a script, basically. So if I want to fail over from one site to another, SRM will do the whole thing for me. HCX is more, like you said, that workload portability. I want to be able to move this thing around. Yep. Being able to recover from specific RTOs and RPOs is less important to me. And it's more important that I can take a currently running workload and move it somewhere else.
But I do have a question about this, or a thought that popped in my head as I was listening to the HCX presentation. And that is, isn't Kubernetes going to solve this problem for me at some point? Think about federated clusters. If I've got a cluster in one region and a different cluster in a different region, I want to pick up a workload and move it. Wouldn't I do that? And then the next question comes up, wait a minute, why would you do that? Wouldn't you just design the application so that you don't have to pick up a workload and move it? In other words, isn't HCX really dealing with the challenge of a monolithic application that we can't change?
Yes, I think that's entirely what it's targeted to, is migrations from one data center to another. The example of the person that I was talking to, they were closing two data centers and migrating down to one new data center. And it was part of a merger and acquisition kind of thing. And HCX let them do that seamlessly with very little downtime. That was a one and done kind of scenario. It's not like they were going to re-architect all of their applications to suddenly use Kubernetes just so they could, you know, merge down to a single data center. Right. It doesn't make any sense, right?
Yeah.
Now, long term, I think you're absolutely right. In the long term, as applications get re-architected, the way that you'll do DR and the way that you do this workload portability thing, especially the workload portability, is you have to replicate the data because data is data. It's not like you can just create that out of thin air, but everything else is going to be defined through Helm charts or Dapper duffels or whatever they're called. And you'll just run that to make your application magically appear in the new location and load whatever data you've synchronized.
But it is an application architecture challenge for that. So,
it is.
You know, but if you just want the one and done tool to get you through for as long as that monolithic app is going to have life, then HCX, great tool. And a lot of people are going to be in this space for a long time, which really speaks to the whole VMware cloud value prop to begin with, I think.
Right. Yeah. We've learned a lot about the long tail of technology, especially with the shortage of COBOL programmers that's happening right now. So if you think the systems are going to go away in 5 years or 10 years, you're probably wrong. So yeah, I wouldn't bet on that one.
That COBOL joke is kind of personal to me. Someone tweeted at me because they'd heard me mention COBOL on a podcast or something and go, oh, your opportunity's here, banks. And because some articles talk about the need for COBOL programmers. You know what I remember about COBOL, Ned? I remember identification division. And that's it. I couldn't tell you anything else. That's the first line you'd have in a COBOL program.
You're already ahead of me. There you go.
All right. So I want to go back to disaster recovery. You mentioned SRM a little bit ago. Well, another thing that VMware showed off on the in this VMC presentation was disaster recovery as a service. And that was effectively SRM. And what they demoed was in their disaster recovery as a service, a platform with a whole bunch of automated runbooks to deal with your disaster recovery scenario. And they gave a specific demo of you've got a bunch of stuff running in New York and you've got a bunch of other stuff in Tokyo just kind of sitting there waiting to be used. Not an active-active, but like an active-passive data center sort of a design, which that's a whole other show, Ned. We can talk about the merits of active-active versus active-passive and so on. But
yes.
But if we just pause there for a minute, the scenario in which VMware presented this was when you have disaster recovery assets that are sitting out there not doing much for you because you're not processing on them because they're your disaster recovery scenario, you're trying to minimize your spend on that. You want to have as few compute assets sitting out there costing you money as possible while still having effective disaster recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And they made the point, okay, so with our disaster recovery as a service, we help you with that. You've got another site, it's sitting there, but you've spun down basically everything. When you have a disaster recovery event, then we're going to begin spinning things up to react to that disaster scenario. So site A goes down, site B then comes up. And it worked real slick in the demo and at PowerPoint. It was lovely.
Wait,
but
a demo worked really slick in a PowerPoint? That's
I know.
Shocking, frankly. Who could have predicted?
So here's the thing about a service like this to me, Ned, is when you are designing for a disaster recovery situation, you have to have your runbooks very correct. And there's two phases to it to me. One is the failover to your disaster recovery site and bring up services live and having that all work. That's phase one. And that's a thing you can automate basically all of that. But what happens when it's time to fail back to your primary site? And this is where I think some folks fall short. In fact, there was some back channel chatter among some of the Cloud Field Day 7 delegates, and someone said, yeah, I know someone who'd built a disaster recovery scenario where it was all automated and site A went down, site B failed over, it was lovely. Then site A came back up while site B was still up and all hell broke loose. Yeah, it was ugly. So
you get into the split brain scenario. If site A comes up automatically and starts trying to process transactions or advertise services, and those services are currently running in site B, then you get that conflict of who is picking up the thing and they're fighting with each other, and you may, lots of bad things can happen. So yes.
And if you're running stretched layer two, where you've got the same IP address space going between site A and site B, it's potentially an astonishing nightmare, because now it's not just DNS conflicts at that point. Now you've got the same devices on the wire contending to be the responder to a query, and you'll have all kinds of data corruption and traffic tromboning and weird potential things that can happen. That's just, you're not going to be processing traffic effectively. That's for sure. None of this, by the way, was a criticism of the VMware's disaster recovery as a service offering here. When you're using tools that are doing a heavy amount of automation, you need to think through the scenario forwards and backwards and have a regular test plan that validates that this disaster recovery and the runbooks as written are still working. So quarterly, I used to work for a company that we did that quarterly, what our disaster recovery scenario. And that was necessary, because almost every quarter it would be some little thing where it's like, oh, this was almost all working, but we forgot. Oh, that's right. We stood up that new thing and forgot to make the mirrored DNS entries or whatever it was. And if you don't do that and you just think, oh yeah, I'm paying for that service, I'm sure it'll be fine. It's not going to be fine.
Dude, the time to test your DR service is not during a disaster.
Right.
Bad idea in general. And you were certainly in the minority of how companies do testing. When I was still working in consulting, I helped put together a solution offering around disaster recovery that we offered out to clients as a service. And it was primarily around planning for people and process. We were pretty agnostic around the tooling. You know, bring whatever disaster recovery solution you want. Our whole value was, okay, we need to plan this out. We need to actually have runbooks that work, and we need to set up a process where you're running it on a regular basis, fail over and fail back. It has to happen. You got to do both. And every company we talk to would be like, yeah, we do DR testing once a year. Mm. And I'm like, the thing that I always went back to, because, you know, running, is I said, what if I told you that I need you to run a marathon tomorrow without any training? Would you make it through? Like, you might. But you would be a disaster. And if you look at people who come out of a DR exercise after 3 days, that's what they look like.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you rather they do the training throughout the year, and then when they actually have to do the thing, they're prepared for it and they aren't complete wrecks?
Well, that's the thing. People think disaster recovery is so disruptive. I don't want to do that testing. It's like, hey, wait a minute. The whole point of disaster recovery is business continuity, right? You don't want it to be disruptive. You want it to be something you're so skilled at and so competent with and comfortable with and knowledgeable about, that when you face a disaster, it just happens and business continues on. That's the whole idea. Mm-hmm. So if you're not testing because you're scared of it, oh man, you really don't want a disaster, do you?
No, you don't. Wow. So DR is probably its own show and we could go down this rabbit hole, but I feel like you might have heard a couple other things going on. I see Tanzu Kubernetes grid in your notes and oh boy, tell me about TKG.
Okay, changing topics. TKG, Tanzu Kubernetes grid. I'm not sure who needs this product, but let me tell you what this product is for as best as I can tell. This is for standing up Kubernetes clusters, no matter where you need to stand them up and being able to manage them centrally. So on the one hand, everybody's going to need this at some point, but I'm not sure when and what the cadence is yet. So the Kubernetes grid is, it gives you an interface whereby you can, no matter what Kubernetes as a service offering that you're using or whether you're doing it bare metal, if I remember right, you can instantiate a new Kubernetes cluster using TKG, Tanzu Kubernetes Grid, which is a VMware product. They bought this at some point. So there is tight integration if you are a VMware customer with TKG into vSphere and VMware Cloud Foundation. So you get that, you know, some magical VMware value add there for TKG. But what's really happening is TKG kind of abstracts away the Kubernetes as a service stuff that you're using. Although as my brain was spinning on that, it's like, wait a minute. Okay, so Tanzu Kubernetes Grid abstracted away the Kubernetes as a service I'm using. Kubernetes is an abstraction from the actual underlying compute that I'm using. So it's like an abstraction on top of an abstraction. And depending on what's underneath that, there could be some more stuff. So there's an awful lot of layers to peel away if you're trying to troubleshoot a problem. And in fact, I remember a question came up during the presentation where one of the delegates said, this seems complicated or complex. And the guy presenting was like, well, why? What do you mean? And we were all like, what? You just said, in what way is it complicated? And I don't know, maybe it isn't, because if you think, okay, so Ned, I got to get your take on this, actually. There's another thought about Kubernetes, which is, okay, we're all, as an industry and as operators, really enamored with Kubernetes. You and I have even done some Kubernetes very focused shows. But do we care? Do we need to care about Kubernetes? And if the argument is, I don't care about Kubernetes, I just want to consume it, I don't really care how it works as long as it works, give me the tools to make it go away so that I can just use it. You love TKG, you know, if that's your way of thinking. If you want to know, on the other hand, the deep guts of Kubernetes and kind of handle that thing, and you want to do, you know, kubectl and type things at the command line and see clustery magic happen, then maybe you don't like this. Yeah, but I don't know. Do we need to know Kubernetes long-term, Ned?
We've gone down this path a little bit before, and I think the short answer is if you're an operator who's responsible for those clusters, yeah, you probably need to know Kubernetes a bit. If in the same way that if you're a VMware administrator, you need to know a bit about VMware. Do you need to know how to get into the ESX CLI and execute all of these arcane commands? The average admin, probably not. You can get by just using the vSphere UI and you're good to go. And I think this is a similar sort of abstraction. It's actually the thing that VMware did perfectly with vSphere was they made it easy to consume virtualization, easy to do clustering, which clustering traditionally very hard to do. They gave a really nice UI and people held on to that original thick client. It was like, you'll take that when you pry it from my cold dead hands. And eventually they forced everybody to HTML5, but there was that Flash monstrosity that no one likes to talk about. I think we're in a similar sort of situation. Kubernetes needs to be consumable through a friendly UI. VMware's good at creating friendly UIs. They are trying to do it with TKG. Will it be successful? Well, there's a lot of other products out there that are trying to do this same sort of thing. So there's a lot more competition than there was in the virtualization space 10 years ago. So it could be anybody's game at this moment.
And I think that is the whole issue. Assuming wide enterprise adoption of Kubernetes over the long haul, that means there's going to be a lot of clusters for enterprises to manage because it's cheap and easy to build a Kates cluster. So why wouldn't you stand up a cluster that caters to a specific application that you want to run on it and then build up a different cluster that behaves in a different way? And so I've talked to a variety of companies lately that come to mind. Spectra Cloud, they're making their own take on how to manage a Kubernetes cluster. Stand up the stack. and then via policy instantiate that stack. How is it being stood up? We're Spectre Cloud. We're taking care of that for you. Rancher with version 2.4 and it's coming soon 2.5. They're betting big on you having a lot of Kubernetes clusters to manage. Okay, VMware, Tansu Kubernetes Grid, another tool that is in that world. There's a lot of technical features and functionality there. This was a rich product, so much so that I couldn't even take it all in. There was a lot there to this product, Ned, that you know that caught my eye. It's definitely worth looking into if you got that need in your life. All right, more stuff I want to talk about, Ned, from my Cloud Field Day 7 attendance. And this was SolarWinds Application Performance Monitoring. Now, if you hear SolarWinds, I'm just curious, Ned, what do you first think of if you think of SolarWinds?
I mean, I do think of monitoring, but I don't think of APM. I think of traditional infrastructure and ops monitoring, and to a certain degree, some level of control and configuration over the end devices.
Yep.
And I don't have a ton of experience with SolarWinds, but when I did try to use it, the number of different products that were under that umbrella became rapidly very confusing to me. It's you aren't steeped in the ecosystem. You're like, the what, use the what with the what? I don't, okay, sure.
And that is because they've done so many acquisitions over the years, so many acquisitions. And the product has just grown tremendously and has a lot of features and functionality. They don't always quickly integrate on the back end, but they do really work on it. I mean, usually their acquisition starts with a reskinning where it begins to look and feel like, oh, this is a SolarWinds product. I know what this is. It's dark gray and orange and has the right logos and fonts. And they lay things out in this modular thing in the web so I can drag little windows around and kind of make a dashboard and so on. And then depending on what you're licensed for, you kind of use it all. And sometimes the data each of the applications generate can be shared with other SolarWinds applications. And sometimes not. It all depends on how long the acquisition has been completed. So let's drill into the application performance monitoring stuff here, especially since this was kind of cloud-centric. Three products in the suite we want to hit. Pingdom, Loggly, and AppOptics. Those three. So two of these are going to be quick because they didn't spend a lot of time on them. But one was Pingdom. What do you think Pingdom does? Have you ever run into it before it was acquired?
It sounds like it's what's up gold, basically. Yeah. I send a ping. Yeah. Are you up? Great.
That's what it was back in the day, was just that. It was simply literally a ping tool. Are you up? Yeah, I'm up. And it would alert you. It had a learning engine if things went badly. But now there's a lot of transactional awareness, so you can do more robust kind of checks like, I want you to send this query to this web server. And then if I get a 500 back as a status code, I want you to send an alert. You can do more of those kind of things. And it's got historical monitoring and all that. So that's there. It's not super fancy or super rich, but there's a lot of core basic functionality that you would use every day within Pingdom. All right, so that's one. Two, Loggly. Loggly was yet another acquisition, and Loggly's log management. And they didn't spend a ton of time showing us Loggly. I mean, it's log management. What do you can search the logs, you can organize the logs, you can have it receive the logs, of course, and you can have it do alerting and so on. The one big thing that they emphasized, which I think is an important segue into the AppOptics part of the conversation, they showed us trace IDs that were embedded in the Loggly logs, where you could highlight if you're in an environment that needs distributed tracing, you rely on that trace ID to be consistent for a transaction as that transaction flows through your infrastructure. And they showed in Loggly how you can highlight and do a search on a trace ID, since that trace ID was embedded as metadata in the log entries. And they didn't spend a lot more time in Loggly than that, other than to kind of give you a sense of all the different things that were going on there with these three apps and how they kind of work together. Where they did spend, they being SolarWinds, did spend a bunch of time was with AppOptics. And this was, I would describe it as like the beast mode tool that really caught my attention. We're like, oh, wow, there's a lot going on here. And that is around distributed tracing. So distributed tracing, this is, I think we've talked about it on the show before, but this is the notion that you've got an application with a bunch of microservices. And so there's, a stack of different servers, if you will, different layers that a transaction from beginning to end might have to go through before it's complete. So you might hit a web front end, which calls a database on the back end. That's pretty common. And along the way, there's some authentication that goes off to the side. And perhaps there's some reporting that gets triggered or some streaming telemetry that happens. There's all these things that could happen in the course of a transaction. All right. How do you know if you're troubleshooting a problem, what went wrong? Because you could have at each layer, like the web front end and the database front end and, you know, all the other, the authentication layers and so on. There could be 15, 20, 100 different servers that go on at a time. And the answer is distributed tracing so that you can follow that transaction all the way through that microservices architecture and break the transaction down each hop along the way. And it's super cool because it's a complex problem. I like complex problems. So in this, you know, we were talking at the top of the show about distributed computing. It's like, well, this is as distributed as it gets. And where AptOptics really caught my attention wasn't merely like, oh, it went to this server and then it went to this server and then it went to this server. You know, it was that, but it was deeper than that. So AppOptics can even show you which bits of code were executing during a transaction and how long it took that code to finish that particular call. So it's not as simple as, oh, I got to server 1964 and it parked there for 45 milliseconds before we get an answer back out of it. It'll break down what happened on server 1964 and say, in this script, it was doing this function call, and that was 90% of the transaction time, and break it all out in a graph, which was like, oh, neat. Now, maybe that's common and you're like not excited about this, Ned, but I looked at that and I hadn't seen any distributed tracing tools go that deep before. And so it really got me excited.
Sure. There's a number of tools in the APM marketplace that do some version of this. And oftentimes what you have to do is get the developers to instrument the code to properly integrate with whatever APM solution you're using. And it's not usually really complicated for them to do. It's usually one or two lines of code they have to add into like the main function of their application or something. And then it takes care of the rest of the tracing and logging. But you do have to do some updating of your code to get that. So if somebody could do it without updating any of the code, that would be amazing. But I mean, especially for compiled code, there's really no way to do that unless you edit the code ahead of time. So that part is, it's not unheard of. The part that becomes really difficult is the awareness of what's going on in a distributed transaction. And the awareness of the layers that are responsible for executing the portions of that transaction. We talked about abstraction models and abstractions on top of abstractions. And if you're trying to get to the root cause of a problem, like what's the bottleneck here? If you're running in a container, which is running on a VM, which is running on a host, and you're running into some sort of processing contention or issues, it's very hard to pin down whether it's the function that a developer wrote. Is it the container that's hitting a constraint? Is it the virtual machine that's hitting a constraint? Is there a noisy neighbor problem? So you not only need that sort of awareness of the application itself, but you also need the awareness of the environment in which it lives.
Well, Ned, let's talk about AppOptics and Kubernetes integration.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Well, I'm just laughing as you're talking through this because AppOptics is they're right on board with that. They understand that challenge. And Kubernetes integration is very straightforward from their perspective. You're going to set up monitoring by dropping a AppOptics daemon set into your Kubernetes cluster. It fires up and then you get very quickly as a result dashboards that are monitoring the replica sets in that cluster and all the various pods and their characteristics like CPU utilization and so on. So all of that whole scenario that you just cited, at least if you're running Kubernetes, you can very quickly nail that down. Not to exclude other bits. I don't remember that they didn't say, oh, like we don't know anything about vSphere. I don't remember that they did or didn't say that particularly. It's just that they did happen to highlight Kubernetes integration. And the demo was pretty cluster-centric from AppOptics, but that was just the demo because I asked Adam, the guy that was doing the presentation, hey, do you need a dashboard per cluster? Because everything in this dashboard he was showing us was like in like just about this one cluster. And I'm like, but you're going to have more than one cluster. You're going to have lots of clusters. He's like, no. This is just how the demo works. You can set up the dashboard however you like, cross clusters if you want, you know, and that's fine. So anyway, AppOptics really caught my attention. I thought it was quite interesting. They also mentioned, and again, I know we've mentioned this on Day 2 Cloud before, but distributed tracing has a lot of open source and standards-based technology behind it, a lot of people trying to rally around different standards that are out there. And AppOptics is trying to play in that standard or generally accepted practice place as well. They mentioned that. I've forgotten all the different groups that are tied up in distributed tracing right now, but
there's a lot.
Yeah, that's exactly why I forgot to write them down, and they're not all leaping to mind because there's several. But it is an emerging and interesting technology that they're
absolutely
the space that they're in here. All right, Ned, one more company I want to talk about. That is an infrastructure company called Pensando Systems. They are somewhat network oriented, and I characterized them at the top of the show as like a startup juggernaut, an emerging monster. And why would I categorize them that way? Well, the founders, if you look at the people who started Pensando Systems, they have a track record of companies that went on to be these multi-billion dollar products, typically Cisco products. So, for example, they were called Insieme. They started that, which was bought and became Cisco ACI. And they helped start the company that ended up being the Cisco UCS product line. And there's some other winners there along the way as well. And so as they were doing the opening, hi, this is who we are and what we do, they kind of led with that. Like, look, we've been awesome in the past. We've created a new thing. So it too shall be awesome, which we'll see. Let's talk about it, Ned. Let's talk about it. So let me give you the background of what Pensando is. So first of all, they're a hardware and software system. The hardware is a SmartNIC, a smart network interface card. So it's got a chip on it that you can program to do all kinds of things and then offload those functions, whatever you program that chip to do, from the x86 box.
Sure.
And that's not new, right? There's SmartNICs out there from a variety of companies, Mellanox, Netronome, and some other ones come to mind. Pensando's chip was designed with... they wanted very high performance. They wanted this thing to be very fast, but they also wanted it to be able to handle very large data centers that might need millions of flow entries. A flow entry being, how do I get from this source on the network to this destination on the network? How do I do that? And also being able to layer in like filtering, like for security and such. Well, you need a chip that can handle millions of flow entries for that. So they built this ARM chip and slapped it on this NIC. So they have this, so they got ASIC or, you know, chip designer kind of people. They made the chip programmable with P4, which is an emerging network programming language. It's vaguely like OpenFlow, if you remember hearing people talk about OpenFlow some time ago, but it's quite different than that and has gotten a lot of following. So with that chip, the ability to program with P4, a smart NIC that you plug into a server, they have then added a policy orchestration engine, you know, that goes on top of that and manages all this whole fleet of smart NICs that you're going to have out there in your data center. Kind of like you'd manage a fleet of servers, you know, with a fleet of hypervisors, vSphere hypervisors with vCenter, you would use their policy orchestration engine to manage all these smart NICs and make them do stuff, whatever the stuff is. So there's the next question. What are you making all these things do? Well, you're making them do, it's basically network function offloads that the x86 box that might have been running, I don't know, a firewalling service or something, you put all that on the SmartNIC so that the SmartNIC just handles it off box and doesn't have to pass that into the x86 CPU. So for right out of the gate with the Pensando solution, you can do a load balancer. You can do telemetry of various kinds. You can do, you know, core basic networking functionality as you'd expect. You can do storage services. They got a bunch of storage functionality in there to offload storage forwarding. You can do micro-segmentation. I'm running out of fingers. You can do encryption and you can do stateful firewalling. Those are all software services that NIC can do without having to hand that functionality up to the x86 box.
Okay. It's interesting from a few different aspects. First, you mentioned that the founders of this were also responsible for UCS. Mm-hmm. And anyone who's worked on a UCS system knows that one of the core strengths of the UCS system is the NIC. The ability on a UCS system to carve up their NIC, their hardware NIC, into multiple virtual network interfaces that can do a number of different smart type things, including storage. So you could have the same NIC serving fiber channel duty as well as doing regular IP or iSCSI all at the same time, all as virtual NICs attached the same. So this is like, okay, we've done this before. This is not net new. So, okay, they've got a solid background in being able to design a chip that is smart enough to do this sort of thing. The other thing I would say is the offload of a general purpose CPU onto these custom chips is something that is happening across the board within server motherboards, because right now the choke point is that CPU.
Yes.
Intel has struggled to improve their performance and get down to the smaller nanometer sizes. Mm-hmm. So that's been a difficult problem. They've also struggled with the whole speculative execution flaws. So now CPUs, in theory, are running slower. And at the same time, you have all this excess capacity on the system board and the NICs that could do a lot more. Hey, let's create these specific purpose chips that can offload some of the responsibilities of what's going on in that CPU. So you have that with GPUs and TPUs and now with smart NICs. Okay, that all makes sense. I'm with you on all this. The part that I stick on is you got to, okay, it can be a load balancer. It can be a stateful firewall. It can do encryption. The software that is doing all this network functionality, is this specific to Pensando? Or are they allowing you to bring your own firewall, bring your own load balancer of choice, and just have the NIC take over that functionality for you? Because for me, that's an important distinction. Do I trust them to make the world's best load balancer? Or do I want to use one that I battle tested before, just using leveraging their better hardware?
So they didn't get into partnerships. They didn't say that there weren't any, but they didn't present that out of the gate. My belief from the way they presented this is functionality you're getting in their orchestration tool, the PSM, the Policy Services Manager. And in fact, along the way, one of the demos was building a centralized firewall policy. Then in PSM, you build the policy, you push that out to the NICs. The policy could be something like traditional five tuple source address, destination address, source and destination port, et cetera, and then put that in as a filtering flow record, or use groups and tags to create your firewall policy, which is something that's a lot more scalable, especially as you get into size. And they compared it to the way VMware NSX firewall policy works. To be clear here, they compared it to. They didn't say, if you're running NSX, you can feed this into our orchestrator and, you know, we'll push that policy into these NICs.
Right.
So, you know, will that happen at some point? I don't know. And in fact, as I was writing down pros and cons for this solution, as I thought about it, I felt like the proprietariness of this whole thing was maybe a negative. It gives you some lock-in. They didn't talk about alignment with other vendors and other software that you might be using. So I'm not sure about that bit yet, or how concerned I am one way or the other. They wanted to sell you the whole system. They weren't selling you hardware with an API and said, we'll integrate with the world. They gave you a full-on solution end to end. I want to go back to some pros though here, Ned, because you mentioned the problem of needing to offload x86, and that is one of the things Pensando cited. They said, yep, anything that we can do to get more compute running on those x86 and less auxiliary functions, that's good because it saves on CPU, saves in your data center footprint. They also made the point, hey, these cards on the average, they're running 30 watts or less of power draw. So they're not, you know, big animals that you need tons and tons of power. You can put them into an existing server. 30 watts of power draw isn't a huge budget that's required there. And you can run these things in a very large network. You can go with a significant scale. Today, you can put in 1,000 of these things and manage them centrally. And I believe 3,000 they're going to be going to very soon. We'll be to manage them as one cluster and have them work as one integrated system. So that's a platform you can build a pretty complex suite of applications on.
Right. Who's going to build that, though? That's what my mind goes to, is you're targeting the largest of enterprises, the largest of providers. Guess what? They already have an automation system and a centralized management system, and they have a policy system that they don't want to rewrite everything to use yours.
So let's go back to my cons. So you've got this system they've built that's incredibly capable and powerful from people that know what they're doing building hardware and software. Okay. But on the negative side, who's going to consume this thing? Well, I don't know that the average enterprise wants this. I think of them as typically, and kind of some of the people they cited were extremely large enterprises with very specific application use cases. They compare themselves to maybe you're building a cloud. You know how AWS bought Annapurna? It's kind of like that. They made that comparison at one point in the presentation as well. So who are they targeting? Not most of us. I mean, it's kind of a specific customer who operates at absolutely huge scale and is trying to deliver very specific applications with a very specific kind of a problem that they need to solve relating to their footprint, you know, and these kind of things. Pensando didn't bring up costs at all, dude. They didn't talk about CapEx and OpEx. They talked a little bit about ROI. Oh. They're like, oh, you can, you know, your ROI calculation is going to be that power savings was 30 watts or less. It's going to be x86. You don't have to have, we just freed up a bunch of that for you with all the offload. Mm-hmm. That's your ROI. And I went, yeah, because the deployment model that they said was greenfield, not crack open all your x86 boxes that you got now and slap one of these cards in there.
Right.
So where's my, how does the ROI work there? I don't get it.
It doesn't. ROIs are generally just complete malarkey, and you could ignore anybody who says TCO or ROI in a presentation because they are just blowing smoke. So we can just move right past that. What I'm thinking is, and they probably, I don't know if they brought this up because I didn't hear you mention it, the edge.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So massive hardware deployments. Mm-hmm. That sounds like edge infrastructure, needing to control the policy and tagging, needing it to be more energy efficient, and needing it to offload critical functions from x86 into a separate processor.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of all of those things, and I'm thinking of how edge is probably going to evolve. And this seems like a perfect solution for the edge.
It wasn't what they emphasized. I'm trying to remember the different use cases they were going through at the end. Certainly 5G came up. So that does make sense that you would put this at the edge. I agree, especially since you've got centralized control where you'd want to be putting a central policy that you roll out to a whole bunch of different locations, you know, at once. That gets your operations costs down. But I'll just counter with, if you look at what some of the edge models are doing, yes, there are increasingly proprietary solutions in the space, but if you look at what the service providers, cloud operators are doing to try to control costs, they've gone to x86, COTS, open source software, white box switching, network disaggregation, I'm rolling my own, I'm building my own apps, and Pensando is the opposite of all of that.
Mm-hmm. And usually I would sell that into an enterprise, right? Because enterprises don't want to roll it, they just want to buy it.
And if you look back at all of the other success stories that the people that founded Pensando have, it's been largely an enterprise play. So this does feel like a bit of a different market for them to go into.
One of the key things to do when you're building a startup is to identify the product, the need in the marketplace, and develop a product around that need. And then being able to pivot a little bit when you realize that you miscalculated on what the actual need is. Hmm. I would posit, and this is total speculation here, but they thought they saw a market need within enterprises and tried to develop a product around it, and they are mid-pivot.
Maybe. I mean, if we go back, they do talk about all the problems that they were trying to deal with the solution. You know, providers moving intelligent into smart NICs, hybrid clouds, the new norm, east-west security as important as north-south, services shifting from physical to virtual, NFV moving to x86, NVMe and those fabrics becoming a thing, containers really matter, you know, which is a snapshot of what life was like 3 years ago.
Mm.
Yeah, things have moved a lot in the last 3 years, and here they are coming to market. So it's not like they missed the boat. It's more like it feels like a lot of these problems have been solved in a lot of ways without one massive overarching solution. But I'll throw one more data point here at you, Ned, because I'm curious to get your take on this. The two major Pensando investors, Oracle Hewlett-Packard, HPE, Hewlett-Packard Enterprise specifically.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. So can I'll riff on this for a minute, and you just tell me where I've gone completely off the rails. All right. So Oracle has a cloud, and most people know that the first iteration of that cloud struggled. The second iteration of the cloud, as we talked to, who is it at? Snell?
Snell Patel, yeah.
Snell Patel. We talked to him, and it's clear that they've evolved, but they're still missing a lot of core functionality. What's a good way to bring in that core functionality? Why V3 of their cloud, which could include these Pensando smart NICs to accelerate their development of network functionality. That totally makes sense. I can see why they would invest. Mm-hmm. HPE, that's a little more interesting. And it makes me wonder if a few different things are happening. One, HPE is heavily invested in developing and pushing out edge systems. They have their edge line systems based on the ProLiant servers that could easily accommodate this sort of smart NIC. And they're already on board with the NIC or a daughter card or something doing additional processing. I believe that's what SimpliVity was all about, was having that daughter card to do that. So I'm wondering if HPE's on board for the edge side of things, or they have a large enterprise customer who they think has this need. And Oracle, I think they're just trying to get to the next version of the hardware that's going to run their public cloud. So how does that line up with what you were thinking?
That's really where my head went as well. Now, of course, this is just speculation in that Oracle and HPE are both so huge with so many different BUs and possible lines of business with different reasons why they might want the solution, that it's hard to nail that down with any certainty. But yeah, where your brain went is pretty much where my brain went. And it all feels about right, which means what's the long term for Pensando? Did one of these investors just swallow them up? Does somebody like Cisco go ahead and just buy them? Since Cisco's got a track record of purchasing these things from these folks that founded Pensando. It's an interesting question, but Pensando doing the big push, it makes me wonder what their goal here is. I'm assuming it's just customer acquisition for now. They're just trying to get some other people interested, talking to them, bring them on board, build up some cash flow while they probably sell this thing off within the next year or two if the economy doesn't completely blow up on us. Yeah.
Well, they've walked into a unique situation where cloud providers are trying to grow like crazy to meet the accelerated demand. So they may score an easy win somehow through that immediate need. I'll also say that in addition to the speculation that I threw out there about Oracle and HPE, both of them and other companies like to invest in startups so they can get a seat at the table and insider information about what that company is doing to see if, are they a threat? Are they something that I should scoop up? Or, you know, I just want to have my ear to the ground and to pay, you know, $500,000 or $2 million to get that level of visibility actually makes sense from a market perspective. So, I mean, that could be all that HP is doing is just knowledge gathering.
Well, another piece of this though, Ned, is if you look at the split of assets, there's hardware and software. Well, they built a really interesting SmartNIC. Now there's other SmartNICs that are somewhat comparable out there, but you've got this piece of hardware now where they developed a chip from the ground up. It does P4. It works with massive scale. And P4 is an industry common language. It's not a proprietary thing, which means someone else could scarf that up if they just want to use that chip or that NIC and program to it. You could build a product set around that. That's also an interesting saleable asset on its own. So it is interesting what they've created here.
Hardware is difficult. Hardware is really hard. And if you have a team that has a proven track record in developing good hardware in the past, they might just push the software to the side. All that proprietary stuff we talked about that we were worried about, no, that'll just all go away. And someone will lay their own software on top of that. I believe that when ACI got spun back in, they rewrote a lot of the software that ran it. And I can tell you that the initial versions of the UCS management software was a nightmare and required Java. So that's
they bought a company to help deal with that, as I recall. I'm trying to remember the name of them, but yeah.
So this might be a similar situation where it does get spun back into Cisco or it gets purchased by somebody else purely as a hardware play. And the software just kind of goes the way of all things. if you will.
Well, Ned, takeaways. Let's wrap this show up here. I got three things that are maybe not going to be immediately obvious, but I will explain myself. So first takeaway here, if you're an engineer, what is the problem that you have as you consider all these products that are out there? What is the problem you have? If you can't articulate the problem that you have, you do not know which product you need, and explaining your problem is harder than you think because we engineers think about technical problems. My problem is I need a different command to use in Python to accomplish this thing. No, that's not the problem you have. Technical problems are not the problem. You have a business problem that technology can be applied to solve. So you need to understand the problem that you have, and that helps inform as you're evaluating like all these different things that Ned and I just talked about, what the right thing might be for you. Kind of a big deal. Another takeaway, Ned, here I've got is, baby, distributed computing is where the world is at or where it's heading. So the more you understand distributed application architecture, particularly how to build infrastructure to support distributed application architecture, that is a crucial skill. And the more of that you know how to do, the better off you're going to be. And so many of the tools I see, they're Band-Aids to handle an application that was not designed to run in a distributed environment. Okay, think about VMware like HCX that we talked about. Well, that's about picking up workloads and moving them. Well, if you built a truly distributed application, when do you ever need to pick up an application and move it? You know, you just change the distribution of it.
Yeah.
Anyway, if you really understand distributed computing, even if you're just an infrastructure person, not like an application designer, I believe that you can lead that digital transformation, you know, that marketing buzzword that they're using that drives me a little crazy. But still, if you can get on board that train, that distributed computing train, because you understand all of those principles and how they work, you're going to be in a technical leadership position within your company. Right. One last takeaway, Ned, and we talked about it a little earlier, so I won't belabor this, but just ask yourself whether Kubernetes is a thing you need to know or whether it's a platform you want to use but not care about. And I'm not saying there's a right answer. I'm just saying you need to figure that out. Think about it for yourself. And I think maybe it comes down to the role you want to play. What do you want to do in your organization as far as managing your organization's Kubernetes infrastructure? Do you want to drive the car or do you want to be a mechanic? I mean, I can, Ned, explain the basics of how an internal combustion engine works, but I am not an auto mechanic. So, and I'm starting to think that for some people, maybe there's a balance of knowing just enough Kubernetes, just enough. You don't want to be ignorant. That's not good. But do you need to be a certified Kubernetes administrator? You know, I don't think there's a right answer. Just that's something worth thinking about. Kubernetes is not going away.
I really like that analogy. There's a lot more drivers than mechanics. And a driver's job is not to fix the car. A driver's job is to deliver goods and services, deliver food, get people from point A to point B. Like, drivers have a totally different function that has nothing to do with understanding the internals of the engine. And if you want to be a mechanic, just remember that there's a lot less slots for that than there are for drivers.
All right, let's bring this Day 2 Cloud episode to an end. If you go to the show notes at packetpushers.net, we've got links to everything we talked about today. I've got a link to the entire Cloud Field Day 7 video playlist. We've got links to the VMware Cloud products that we talked through, Disaster Recovery as a Service, HCX, Tansu, Kubernetes Grid, all the SolarWinds stuff, and Pensando, a bunch of links there for you as well. So virtual high fives to you if you made it this far. We're going almost an hour here, so well done you. If you have suggestions for future shows, something you want Ned and I to talk about or have a guest on to be smart and make you smarter too, hit us up on Twitter at ecbanks, at ned1313, and of course the podcast itself at Day2CloudShow, or the form on Ned's fancy website, nedthecloud.com. You got choices, man. You can do whatever you want. Now, if you like content like this and you'd like to go even deeper, hey, you can support the Packet Pushers Podcast Network directly by becoming a member at ignition.packetpushers.net. $99 a year, not a month, not a week, $99 a year at Ignition gives you access to our growing library of white papers, courses, videos, long form articles, and analysis that we do not publish anywhere else. We're trying to make you smarter. We're trying to make it cheap for you. That's the whole idea. So hopefully ignition.packetpushers.net would be something you'd be willing to invest in for yourself and to help us out here at Packet Pushers. And until then, just remember, cloud is what happens while IT is making other plans.